From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, in West Virginia, weeks of confusion about water safety has taken a toll.
It's hard. I cannot live like this with the bottled water. It drives me crazy that I can't just use regular water out of my sink.
We'll meet a priest in L.A. who turns gangbangers into productive citizens.
This is the exit ramp off of that crazy violent freeway. So they can imagine, the gang members can imagine the possibility of redirecting their lives.
Also, how having the right skills saved some Nazi war criminals from justice.
It was no longer a question of who should be hanged. It was a question of who should be hired.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. There are some basic things we take for granted, at least in the developed world. That the air we breathe or the water that flows into our homes won't make us sick. So imagine you turn on your local TV news to this.
State of emergency in several counties tonight after a chemical spills into the water supply. Good evening.
In Charleston, West Virginia, this was the news on Thursday, January 9th. A one-inch hole had opened up in the side of a chemical storage tank, and a substance known as crude MCHM was gushing out into the Elk River and the water supply of some 300,000 people.
Do not drink, use, bathe with, cook with, or do laundry with water from West Virginia American Water. The only thing that you can use it for at this time is to flush your toilet or for fire protection.
That was more than a month ago. State and federal authorities have said that the water is now usable for all purposes. But in some areas, the tap water still has a chemical odor, leaving a lot of ordinary West Virginians and some health authorities wondering, is the water really safe? Despite assurances from government officials, many people in West Virginia are still going to great lengths to avoid the tap water. NPR's Brian Naylor went to Charleston, and as he reports, life there is anything but normal.
Nate May's Prius is loaded down with water. The back is filled with boxes, each holding 3 one-gallon jugs that he's just bought at Walmart. He and other volunteers are driving around Charleston, dropping off jugs to people who have contacted his group, the West Virginia Clean Water Hub. It's a citizen effort operating on donations.
There are a lot of people this is put in a difficult bind. Some of them can't get out. Some of them are elderly. Some of them, it's just too much of a financial burden.
One of his first stops this morning, the second floor apartment of Nakisha Bennett.
Nakisha, I'm here to deliver some water. I'm with the Clean Water Hub. Your dad told me about you.
Sorry, I was feeding my baby.
No problem.
Nakisha's baby is 3-week-old Eli.
I actually was like in the middle of like eating dinner and drinking water. Yeah, and I was pregnant, so I started freaking out.
What did the doctors tell you?
They just told me to drink the bottled water and stuff.
And so now with his formula, you mix it with bottled water?
Yeah, and that's kind of hard to do, because we went through cases and cases and cases of water.
Nakisha says she has no idea how long she'll have to go on fixing Eli's formula and bathing him with bottled water, and she's pretty fed up.
I just feel like there are, like, a lot of people who, are, like, aren't doing their jobs or something. I mean, it's hard. I cannot live like this with the bottled water. It drives me crazy that I can't just use regular water out of my sink.
Charleston is the state's population center, the center of its government. And there are lawyers and lobbyists and other people here who know how to make themselves heard. Maya Nye, who's president of People Concerned About Chemical Safety, says maybe this leak will have an impact in a way that previous accidents in more isolated places in West Virginia have not.
I do believe it's a tipping point. 300,000 people, you hit them on sort of a basic human survival level, and I mean, this has been ongoing for a month now, you know, and I'm still not drinking the water, using it, and a lot of people I know still aren't.
West Virginia's members of Congress have called for laws to ensure testing of storage tanks like the one owned by Freedom Industries that leaked, and for more oversight of West Virginia's many other chemical facilities. But University of Charleston professor Brad Deal isn't optimistic that big changes are coming in the state's light-handed regulation of the coal and chemical industry.
What I predict will happen is that people are going to make a lot of noise. There will be some minor regulations passed. To the extent anything major is proposed, people will say, well, let's not be too hasty. Let's not make any rash changes. Industry will open its wallets and its lobbying organizations to the politicians, and very little will happen.
Meanwhile, in St. Albans, just outside Charleston's water system,
we came here and did a little pizza picnic, and then now we're finishing with that.
Sounds like a great adventure.
It has been. Can you guys say hello? These are my
friends.
Come on, let's let them in the house.
Hi.
Okay. Let's let the gentleman in the house.
Joanne Kirby and her three lively kids are having a pizza picnic. Kirby lives in Charleston, but along with three other families, has rented a small apartment in St. Albans so they can bathe the kids and wash their clothes in clean water. The families use a Google Calendar to keep track of whose turn it is to use the place. Kirby, a lawyer, says their family doesn't use the water in their home at all.
One day, my daughter was brushing her teeth, and she turned on the faucet by mistake and wet her toothbrush and then just dropped it and burst into tears. And you know, that's not a great feeling as a parent. You know, you're doing the best to keep a routine and keep calm, yet the kids pick up on the tension and they're aware.
Aurelia Kirby is six.
And Mommy said even if other kids are using the water, we do not use the water.
Richard Katz is another lawyer whose family shares the unfurnished apartment.
It works out real well. It's worked out great so far. Unfortunately, I'm afraid we might have to have the place for another month at least.
Katz and the other families know they're fortunate to have the means to escape Charleston's water. Katz says unless it's resolved soon, the water crisis may make some people escape the area for good.
I can tell you from talking with other professionals here, other highly skilled workers, that we're watching. And if there is no meaningful change, there will be a brain drain here.
As these families leave their shared apartment, the last thing they do is turn on the faucet and fill some jugs to take home.
That's NPR's Brian Naylor. The water has been contaminated for residents in 9 counties. At a congressional hearing in West Virginia, their representatives demanded the answer to that simple question we asked earlier: is the water safe? Here's Congresswoman Shelley Moore Capito questioning the state's Commissioner of Public Health, Letitia Tierney.
Dr. Tierney, is the water safe to drink?
That's, in a way, a difficult thing to say because everybody has a different definition of safe. Am I confident in the science? I believe the water, based on the standards we have, is usable for every purpose, and that includes drinking, bathing, and cooking.
Dr. Rahul Gupta is a public health official at the local level. He's the executive director of the Kanawha Charleston and Putnam County Health Departments. He says the confusing and conflicting guidance from state and federal officials has made life very difficult.
It may be a four-letter term, but it is part of the federal law, the Safe Drinking Water Act. It is not Appropriate Drinking Water Act. It is not Okay Drinking Water Act. Is it safe or is it not safe? And we just, at a local level, don't have the tools to make that determination. We really depend on our state and federal partners. And we continue to seek answers for that one question.
Many residents are disturbed by the lingering telltale sign of chemicals in their water, an oddly sweet smell.
If you go to the store and you get a package of the black licorice, I think the packages have 20 licorice sticks in it.
Mm-hmm.
You open that up and you take a big sniff. That's exactly what the water smells like in some of these houses.
That's Andrew Welton. He's a professor at the University of South Alabama, and he's part of an independent team that this past week started testing the water at people's homes. He says there are a lot of unknowns about the water, including the fact that there's very little information on how MCHM affects human health.
There's only a few studies that have been conducted on rats and animals, and none of the studies have any human data associated with them or even juvenile animals. There simply isn't much data available to really shore up what levels are completely safe for individuals.
Authorities in West Virginia have been testing the water from the beginning of the crisis. Could you explain, though, why it's important to test the water in people's homes, in individual homes, in this way?
The authorities in West Virginia have been testing water at fire hydrants, schools, and hospitals since the beginning of the crisis. It's important to test inside people's homes because the materials that are used to transport water and to store water outside the homes are very different than those materials that are used to transport water and store water inside the homes. Simply put, there's little to no information about what happens to, for example, this contaminated water once it went into people's houses.
Dr. Weldon, where does the testing go from here, and when will we have more results?
In the next 3 weeks, we will have been on the ground, and we will have collected all of the data from the 10 homes. So we'll, at that point, we'll have shipped water samples throughout the country. And so we're looking at least a month, if not a month and a half to 2 months, before we'll really have some definitive results.
That was Andrew Welton, along with his colleague Jeffrey Rosen from Corona Environmental Consulting. He's leading a group thoroughly testing the tap water at people's homes. As he says, it will be at least a month before they get results. Meanwhile, the crisis has already done real psychological damage. Dr. Rahul Gupta.
What we are seeing is obviously a lot of anxiety, panic in some people, anger and frustration. Just a week ago, we've had up to 14 schools in a day report complaints of odors. The day prior to that, we had 2 schools we had to close. The following day after that, we had 3 schools, but there were about 14 schools on the verge of closure. This is all having some cumulative impact on psychological aspects of our children as well as adults. And I think it's important to not neglect to monitor these.
Dr. Gupta, from where you're sitting right now, how long do you think this crisis is going to last?
Well, it needed to be over several weeks ago. It is still continuing. We are hoping that a number of activities can be put in place by our leaders that will help and allow people to heal and to ensure to the public that their water in their taps is safe. It is very critical, I cannot emphasize enough, that people need to know that their water coming out of their taps is safe.
That was Dr. Rahul Gupta. He says people in West Virginia have been left to make their own decisions about whether to use the water. But when authorities won't directly answer if the water is safe, that's no easy choice. This is NPR News. We have an update now on the efforts to end the civil war in Syria. A second round of talks in Geneva this week ended in a stalemate. Both sides have raised questions about whether a third round will go forward at all. In Homs this week, some residents were allowed to flee the city, which has been under siege for more than 2 years, the only tangible success from the negotiations. Across the country, though, civilians are dying at an alarming rate. In a recent article for National Geographic magazine, Ann Barnard paints a picture of life in Syria's capital, Damascus.
We can't say it's exactly normal. You hear shelling in the distance all the time, and every now and then there is a mortar that will land somewhere in the city. But compared to what's going on in the rest of Syria, it really is a bubble of normalcy, one that nobody is exactly sure how long it will last, but people are shopping, going to work, there are traffic jams, there are nightclubs open, maybe not as busy as they used to be. And within just a few blocks of some neighborhoods, you can come to a neighborhood on the outskirts that is guarded by checkpoints and where entire blocks are completely destroyed by shelling and fighting.
Peace talks in Geneva have failed to really get off the ground. Do you have a sense of what average Syrians in the capital are expecting to happen in their city in the coming months?
Well, the sense in Damascus is almost one of resignation. There's a feeling that this has become their new normal. Whether they are supporters or opponents of the government, and there certainly are both within Damascus, even though it's the government-held capital, their biggest fear is that the city will be destroyed, although in a way they have a new fear now, which is that the situation will just go on forever and it will be destroyed, as it were, from inside by economic despair, displaced people overwhelming the city, and just a loss of spirit, a loss of this special flavor that Damascus has always had.
Well, can you talk about that a bit? Because you delve into the rich history of the city in your piece. If you could talk a bit about why Damascus has been for so long celebrated for what you call its model of coexistence.
Damascus is one of the world's oldest continuously inhabited cities, and it's been viewed for centuries in the Arab world as a beacon of refinement and civilization. All different kinds of people would come together, trade together, work together, live together. not without conflict, but with a shared love for city life and business and sitting in cafes and doing deals. And that's still true today.
So is there a fear then that the city's going to go the way of these other great cosmopolitan cities like, you know, Sarajevo or Beirut, where there once had been, you know, that are now kind of devolved into sectarian conflict?
People in Damascus say that they sort of can't imagine having a sectarian conflict inside Damascus, but that's what people often say before something like that happens. Most people view the war as something that did not begin with sectarianism. It began with a political conflict, and it still is primarily that. But at the same time, there's also a fear that the city will end up like an example much closer to home, which is Aleppo, north of Damascus, an equally beautiful city with an even larger old city that has been ravaged since rebels entered the city, not necessarily with the consent of residents, and then the government shelled, and you ended up with centuries of history being lost and damaged. Some of them even told us that they would be the first to object if armed groups tried to come inside Damascus and use it as a base, even if they're looking for those armed groups to nominally win this conflict. They don't want the war to be in Damascus.
I want to talk about one of the characters in your article. His name is Samir Nassan. He's 65 years old. He's a rich and powerful man living in a fancy house in Damascus. Tell us about him and how he views the war.
Well, Samir Nassan lives in a house which is completely decorated by these sepia-tone photographs of his ancestors. They founded a company which had workshops that made the crafts that Damascus is so famous for, and he sees it as a symbol of Damascene diversity. He told me that Jews worked in his father's factories making brass objects, that Christians made the Damascene wooden mosaic furniture that you may see in many Syrian government offices and in restaurants and in everybody's homes, and that Muslims made the silk brocade. And he spoke about this with so much pride, but then when I asked him how he thought the conflict should be solved, he said, if I were Bashar al-Assad, I would finish it in 5 days, even if I have to kill 5 million Syrians. So it was quite a contrast between this sense of diversity and coexistence and refinement and civilization and his prescribed solution for the conflict.
Anne Bernard's article about life in Syria's capital, Damascus, is in the current issue of National Geographic. Anne, thank you.
Thank you so much.
It has been an ugly winter. In the past 2 weeks, a pair of storms has made life miserable across the eastern U.S. On Thursday, much of the south and northeast were buried in snow and ice. At least 26 people have died. Tens of thousands of flights have been canceled, rail service delayed, and roads in many cities are still impassable. Meanwhile, more than 1 million customers lost power during the storm. Thousands of homes and businesses are still without electricity. From the deep south to the northeast, forecasters are working double time.
The Weather Channel has just named its 17th winter storm of the season.
From the heaviest snowfall this winter.
A cold and windy afternoon.
75,000 domestic flights canceled, and we're still.
And that is where the forecast gets very tricky.
So who takes the blame when cities are unprepared for weather disasters? Weather forecasters or politicians? Thomas Bogdan heads up the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research. It's a group that oversees national weather studies, and he says that forecasting can definitely get a lot better.
Forecasts have improved a lot over the years, but the demands on those forecasts have probably increased even faster than they have. You know, as society gets increasingly complex and interconnected, and we operate closer and closer to the margins of our systems, we're increasingly vulnerable to winter storms, such as the one that hit Atlanta last month. So first of all, it's trying to improve our models to deal with the timing and location, which are critical to what's going on. And then it's also completing that forecast, finding a way to take the information we have about the physical system and translate it into information that the average person can use to make good decisions about whether they go out, when they come home from work, if they pick up the kids from daycare and things like that.
What are some of the things that can be done on the ground to make weather forecasting more accurate?
Certainly on the ground, one of the key things is to bring more data into the forecast. And what's exciting now is the potential of crowdsourcing. You think about smart automobiles. They know the temperature outside. They know whether they've been using their anti-lock brakes. They know whether the high beams are on or whether they've used the windshield wipers. The Department of Transportation has funded a winter study in the states of Michigan, Minnesota, and Nevada, where they are deploying small sensors on plows. Even your cell phone, if you think about it, knows some critical things about the weather around you. And so each and every one of us with a smartphone can potentially be a small weather station. And that knowledge, that very dense knowledge, is what we need to nudge the forecasts and keep them accurate.
You've also pointed out that we're good at predicting two things. That would be immediate weather, say that there's a big storm coming tomorrow, and long-term trends like an ongoing drought. But you've noted we're terrible at predicting weather over the medium term, like months or a year. Why is that?
Indeed, the intermediate forecast is an area where scientists are very excited about trying to make some progress. We're talking about timescales from maybe 1 month to one decade as this intermediate area that I like to refer to as WIMET or CLEATHER, where you put weather and climate together and make a word that's unpronounceable. In this area, it's fascinating that the ocean is the planet's memory on these timescales. And so the atmospheric sciences community and the oceanic community are really marshaling their forces to try to put together global Earth system models that really include the ocean on the same par as the atmosphere. Of course, we will never be making predictions that it's going to rain at 2:30 on February 17th, 2018. That's not the way it's going to work. It's going to be probabilistic, but the economic impacts of getting this right are huge. If you think about companies, water resource managers, people in agriculture, there are so many decisions that our society has to make. And right now, without really good information on those timescales, they are encountering a lot of risk.
What are some of the ways that meteorologists can get better at delivering their message to the public?
I think part of it is working with public officials that actually have to make decisions and understand what their criteria are. What is the threshold at which they have to begin considering taking actions that are out of the ordinary to respond to a situation? And once those thresholds are understood by the weather community, then you don't give information before you're at that threshold because it's not information that's actionable.
Now, in terms of the decisions that affect people's lives, obviously the meteorologists, the National Weather Service, don't decide when to close schools and that sort of thing. So on the side of local governments, are there things that they could be doing that could be doing a better job?
Well, I think communication is the key here. Atlanta's a really interesting situation to observe. They had the same type of event come back basically 1 week later after the first event, and the reaction was totally different from what they did there. And it was because relationships had formed between the officials and the weather people that provide that information. That trust was there, and lessons had been learned from the first time through.
That's Thomas Bogdan, president of the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, on a rough couple of weeks of winter weather. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Arun Roth. Wernher von Braun designed the rockets that took man to the moon. He also designed the Nazi rockets that killed thousands during World War II. Von Braun always portrayed himself as a reluctant Nazi and completely unaware of the concentration camps. That was a lie. But instead of hanging at Nuremberg, von Braun and many other Nazi scientists and doctors, including some who had approved experiments on concentration camp inmates, ended up helping the U.S. war effort. This was thanks to a secret government program revealed in detail in Annie Jacobson's new book, Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program to bring Nazi scientists to America. Operation Paperclip began in the fall of 1944, when the advancing Allies began to gather intelligence about Nazi weapons.
This is a dark time. This is the fall of 1944. So it's just a few months after the landings at Normandy, and you've got Allied forces making their way across the continent, headed toward Berlin and Munich. And with them, sort of scattered among the soldiers, are these small teams of scientific intelligence officers, and they are searching for the Reich's weapons. And they don't know what they might find. One example was they had no idea that Hitler had created this entire arsenal of nerve agents. They had no idea that Hitler was working on a bubonic plague weapon. That is really where paperclip began, which was suddenly the Pentagon realizing, wait a minute, we need these weapons for ourselves.
And so realizing that to understand the Nazi science, they needed the Nazi scientists as well.
Absolutely. And there begins the conundrum, because it suddenly dawned on these military officers, wait a minute, I've got Wernher von Braun right here. It was no longer a question of who should be hanged. It was a question of who should be hired.
And that brings us, I guess, to the central, really nauseating moral tension of this book, which is that these experts, these scientists, are also pretty much ardent Nazis and people who were involved in the mass destruction in Europe and the final solution of the Holocaust. So Paperclip has to figure out how to get these scientists in a way that's morally acceptable.
And there began a propaganda campaign by the U.S. government to whitewash the past of these scientists who we very much knew were ardent Nazis. And it happened on a number of levels, from the bureaucrats in Army intelligence who were asked to sort of rewrite the dossiers, on up to the generals in the Pentagon who flatly said, we need these scientists and we're going to have to rewrite some history. And that's where it becomes very tricky and very nefarious. You have to be a Nazi ideologue to move up that chain of command so high. I mean, it's almost like someone who is, let's say, a hedge fund manager in the United States trying to take the line that they don't believe in capitalism, you know, that they're just trying to earn a living for their family. I mean, if you're going to rise to the top of your field, you maintain the party line. And that is what I found was the case with Paperclip.
Let's talk about some of these men in particular. I think a great place to start would be with Wernher von Braun, who I considered him heroic when I was a kid because he was responsible for the rockets that took men to the moon. He said that it was always really about the science. He was always thinking about space, and he was a reluctant Nazi.
I found otherwise. And, he is a great example, because you wonder where the deal with the devil really happened in terms of his whitewashed past, because the U.S. government, NASA in particular, was so complicit in keeping his past hidden. And in doing the research, one discovers that, not only was von Braun an ardent Nazi, but a member of the SS. And not only was he running the underground slave labor facility where his rockets were being built, he wasn't running the facility, but he was in charge of the science there. But when they were running low of good technicians, Wernher von Braun himself traveled nearby to the Buchenwald concentration camp, where he handpicked slaves to work for him as laborers. And when you see that kind of activity during the war, and you have to imagine what he saw and what he knew, it's impossible to excuse him from his Nazi past.
Another thing that's really remarkable in this is that after this rush to acquire the secrets of Nazi biological and chemical weapons, there was a great push to get our own biological and chemical weapons program up and running using these same men.
And, through the lens of history, this all seems like one tragedy compiled on another. When you consider that right now, Syria's chemical weapons are being destroyed at great expense. Those are the chemical weapons that were developed by the Nazis. And I write about this at length and located some astonishing documents that had never before been revealed, showing that Army officers with the Chemical Corps worked and enjoyed working with some of Hitler's closest scientists. I mean, the men who he gave financial bonuses to, that's how much he liked them. Another example was a Dr. Walter Schieber, who was Himmler's right-hand man on his personal staff, also a chemist. And after the war, we rounded up this group of chemists, Nazi chemists, who had developed sarin gas and tabin gas, and we used their expertise to build up our arsenal, which only, decades later was considered considered absolutely not something that anyone wanted in this world and was, you know, destroyed.
You see how the lives of these men play out. And you know, you mentioned Dr. Schreiber. He ultimately had to leave America, but died of natural causes in Argentina in the end, right?
They all had different trajectories, but none of them seemed to have been held accountable for what happened and what they were involved in during the war. Dr. Benziger, who was one of the Nazi doctors, came here, and when he died at the age of 90-something, he had a wonderful obituary in the New York Times lauding him for inventing the ear thermometer. Entirely left out of the story was the work that he performed on concentration camp prisoners.
You talk about the sign that was over the Buchenwald gate, the concentration camp, Jedem das Seine, which is basically, you get what you deserve. And it has a kind of a dark resonance for you at the end of this book.
It really does, because, you know, I interviewed some of the survivors of the concentration camp, and Gerhard Machowski was a 19-year-old boy spared the gas chamber. And when you speak with someone like that and you see the impact that Nazi ideology had on not only that individual but on this world, it really makes one question and wonder, does everyone get what they deserve?
Annie Jacobson, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Annie Jacobson's new book is Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program to bring Nazi scientists to America. This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Meet Lieutenant Charles Levins from the Michigan Department of Corrections. Like many people, he spent a lot of time working indoors this winter. One day last December was especially brutal.
Well, that day was a bad snow day. We were not working too much in the field. The roads were horrible. The temperatures were below zero, and it was a good day to work on some cold cases.
And that's where our next story begins. Confined to his office, Lieutenant Levins pulled out an old file on a woman named Judy Lynn Heyman, an escapee who broke out of a Michigan prison back in 1977.
Our department policy requires that any of our cold cases or escapee cases from the 60s and 70s be investigated at least once a year to see if we can follow up or come up with any new leads, anything we can try to do to solve the case and get them back into custody.
Heyman had been arrested for shoplifting in a store in Detroit. She served only half her sentence before vanishing 37 years ago. Lieutenant Levin sent her fingerprints off to the FBI Special Processing Unit.
And 2 weeks later, hit the jackpot.
The fingerprints matched those of a 60-year-old woman who was once arrested on drug charges in 1980. She was now living across the country in San Diego. Police arrived at her apartment last week and met a woman who said her name was Jamie Lewis. She even had documents to prove her identity. Lieutenant Kevin Mayer from the San Diego Police Department says the officers were suspicious.
One of the officers, he had a picture of Ms. Heyman from 1977, and he was looking at that picture and compared it to the woman who was identifying herself as Jamie Lewis. And what he told me was the eyes gave her away. There was something distinctive about her eyes that led him to believe that this was, in fact, the wanted fugitive.
Ah, the eyes. She was taken in for questioning and later admitted her true identity. The woman living as Jamie Lewis was Judy Lynn Heyman, fugitive. The matter now rests with the San Diego police. As unique as this case is, it brings on a strong sense of deja vu for Lieutenant Levins. Just 6 years ago, he was investigating a different cold case, Susan Lefevre. Sent to prison for a heroin deal, she escaped in 1976.
Kind of the same situation. The roads were bad and snowy, so I decided to work on a cold case, and I started going looking through her old prison file and some of the old files that other investigators had worked up on her over the years, and found a couple relatives that still lived in the Saginaw area here in Michigan.
After a string of interviews and an anonymous tip, Levins found Lefevre in 2008, also living in San Diego, under the name Marie Walsh. After her release from prison, Lefevre appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show in 2011, recounting her life as a wanted fugitive.
After 10 years, 20 years, Are you always looking over your shoulder?
It was always, how will this story end? Will I die and this will be a deathbed thing to my kids? Will it be that I'm having a dinner party and the SWAT team comes in and accidentally shoots one of my kids that screams from upstairs or something? I never knew.
She told Oprah that she was in her yard gardening when police took her back into custody. She spent 13 months in prison before returning to San Diego. Again, Lieutenant Kevin Mayer.
Kind of a coincidence that it was another one here in San Diego from their state. Perhaps it's the weather.
Lieutenant Levins isn't done, and he has this to add.
I can assure you, if you're one of those people that are still out there from the 60s and 70s, we're still looking for you.
So, if you're on the lam from a Michigan prison, listening to this right now, there's only one thing you can do. Pray for good weather. Here's a brilliant idea to stop gang violence. Just get the rival gang members together in a nice kitchen and have them bake bread. Are you laughing? Well, stop, because it really works. When Father Greg Boyle, a Jesuit priest, started Homeboy Industries 26 years ago, it was a small bakery in a gang-torn neighborhood in downtown L.A. That bakery led to a catering service and a cafe. It looks as nice as any Starbucks. Homeboy Industries is swarming with activity today. Upstairs, there's a GED class. Downstairs, gang tattoo removal. There are counseling services and classrooms where former gang members are learning how to do a job interview. Father Greg, or Father G, as he's called around here, works with 15,000 former gang members a year. His success rate is astounding. 70% of people who walk through these doors don't return to prison.
There are about 120,000 gang members in L.A. County, so I would suspect that all of them know about this place, and this is the exit ramp off that crazy violent freeway. So they can imagine, the gang members can imagine the possibility of redirecting their lives.
Well, this, to describe for people, this office is just lined with photos. A lot of before and after photos,
yeah,
that are quite dramatic of people.
Well, everything here, they're all gifts, you know. And some of them are kids I've buried. I've buried 193 young people who I've known. And so there are pictures of them. But there are a lot of, you know, kids at their baptism, you know, and, you know, a variety of things.
And can you talk about the background of these young people? Because people have an idea, well, these are gang members or former gang members, but more of who they are, what kind of families or what kind of backgrounds they're coming from.
Well, the profile of any kid who joins a gang is somebody who's stuck in a despair that they can't really see their way out of that, and they can't imagine tomorrow. And then the other profile is the kid who's so traumatized and damaged that he or she can't see their way clear to transform their pain, so they keep transmitting it. And the third profile is the mentally ill kid. Around here, we always invite people to stand in awe at what folks have to carry rather than stand in judgment at how they've carried it.
With over 200 trainees, volunteers, and part-time employees, paying for an operation this big is a constant challenge. Government funding was once 20% of the organization's annual $14 million budget. Funding cuts have reduced that to just 3%.
It looks like in 2014 we've lost essentially $1 million from the government. Our argument, of course, is we serve this entire county, and there isn't a zip code that has gangs that hasn't seen a member from those gangs walk through our doors. If they're here, they're not in jail, and if they're here, they're not in state prisons. And we're helping to turn around the recidivism rate in a way that's really significant.
I know one of the services that you offer is tattoo removal. And in fact, the gentleman who was signed in right ahead of us was here for tattoo removal. If you can explain what that means for these young people.
Yeah. We have a designated clinic here. We have 30 volunteer doctors, one paid physician's assistant, and 46,000 laser treatments a year. So there's no place on the planet Earth that removes more tattoos than we do.
These are, I don't want to be specific, these are the gang tattoos.
The gang-related tattoos on their face and neck and elbows down. Any mistake we've ever made, we can't erase. But this is one you can.
This will help take away. It's a long process. I'm on the process of taking my tattoos away. And it hurts bad.
It does?
Yeah.
Did it with a laser?
A laser, yeah. It's excruciating.
Meet 23-year-old Garay Bastida from East L.A.
I always had in mind to come here, but I just didn't have the courage to come. So when I got out this time, like 3 months ago, I just got a little tired of going to jail, and I felt like I needed to work on myself. So I came here, and I'm doing good. Instead of being in the streets, like selling drugs or gang banging, I'm in here.
So what has this meant for you, like work like this, like honest work?
It's giving me experience to get ready for a job out there. I want to be a better father. I want to make my dad happy. I love Father G saved my life. I love Father G.
We're kind of a tough sell, but we're a good bet. There's still a lingering sense of demonizing, I suppose. It's not a shelter for abandoned puppies. It's a center of second chances for felons and gang members. And so this is smart. What if we were to invest in folks rather than futilely and endlessly try to incarcerate our way out of this problem, which doesn't make any sense?
Father Greg Boyle. He's the founder of Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles, the largest gang intervention program in the nation. This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth.
Well, this is a tune that I got from the late, great Jimmy Rogers.
Coming up through the Greenwich Village folk scene more than 50 years ago, John Hammond collected the work of some of the greatest blues artists of all time. On his latest album, that music is presented as bare bones and honestly as possible. Just Hammond, his guitar, and his harmonica. And a deeply appreciative audience.
Oh, I'm gone away, baby. Why are you off my mind? I'm gone away, baby. Why are you off my mind? Why you keep me worried, bothered all the time?
John Hammond is celebrating 5 decades of recording with an album called Timeless. He plays modern songs along with a healthy dose of classic blues from the likes of Elmore James, Howlin' Wolf, and Sleepy John Estes. It sounds like a survey of his career, but like all of his shows, the set list is improvised.
I kind of make it up as I go along. I know about 400 songs and or more. But in this particular case, I knew that we were being recorded, so I sort of hand-selected my wife Marla and I picked out some songs. I did 25 songs, of which we picked 15, I think.
Ooh, tell me, honey, what in the world is going on? Ooh, tell me, what in the world is going on? You know, I woke up this morning, trouble knocking on my door.
So, hearing some percussion-y sounds on here, are you a foot stomper? Is that you?
I'm a foot stomper. I have no control over my foot. It's another part of the band.
Is that something you picked up from other blues guys? Does everybody do that, or is that just your foot doing its thing?
It's what I do. I've seen other guys that actually have microphones on their feet, or they have a stomping board. I just hope for the good stage.
I read a review of this new record that says it was like a living, breathing history lesson. I wonder how you feel about that description.
Well, I'm not a teacher. I have a lot of experience with some of the greatest blues masters. I came on the scene at a time when a lot of the great country blues players were being rediscovered. So I got to be on shows with all of them, including Bucca White and Skip James, Son House, Mississippi John Hurt, Fred McDowell. I could just go on and on. It was just an amazing experience in the beginning.
How were you able to, you mentioned, for instance, Skip James, like in a tune like Hard Times.
Yeah.
It feels like your voice is coming right out of the 30s. I mean, it feels like you've lived that.
Well, all the songs that I do, I make my own one way or the other. This is stuff I truly feel and truly live, you know, and these are songs that I put all of myself into. Now you hear me sing this old worry song, but his hard times have lasted so very long. Hard times have lasted so very long.
You lead off the album with something that sounds like it could have been a classic Bo Diddley song, but it's actually by Tom Waits. That's
right.
No One Can Forgive Me But My Baby.
I crack a mean whip, carry a big gun, cast a long shadow till the day is done. Do 90 miles an hour down the devil's trail, done a hard time in 100 jail. No one can forgive me but my baby.
He came to a recording date I was doing in San Francisco back in 1992. John Lee Hooker had sat in to do a duet with me, and Tom Waits appeared out of nowhere and said, "Oh, I have a song for you, man. I wrote this song." And it was about 20 minutes long, and everybody in the Bible coming down to the river. And I said, "Gee, you know, it's a great song, but I don't think I could do anything like that." He said, "Oh, you don't like that one?" So he goes into the control room, and about 10 minutes, he wrote this song, and comes out and says, "Well, man, I know you know some badass songs. Well, check this one out.
I don't pay no bills, I don't say no prayers, give back nothing and I take all this."
So I did it, and he had left by the time we completed it, and so I sent him a cassette of it, and I hadn't heard from him for a while, so I called and he had it on his answering machine. I guess he liked it.
No one can forgive me but my baby.
I'm speaking with blues master John Hammond. His new album is called Timeless. I want to play something for you from a newcomer on the scene. This is a kid in his early 20s. Let's take a listen to this.
Well, my first name is Johnny. I ain't gonna tell you my second name.
That is you from, I think, 1964.
1962.
My first
recording.
Well, if you catch me stealing, Lord, I don't mean no harm. I'm just stealing people now, trying to get them home.
How has your approach to music changed since then?
It hasn't really changed. I'm the same person. I can't believe I'm 71 years old, but I have the same energy. I love the music just as much or more. Hopefully I've gotten a little better.
For a lot of people, after, the standard thing is 50 years on the job, you start preparing for retirement. But I don't think blues men, you know, get the gold watch. Or
You're right.
But any thoughts ever about slowing down at all, or are you just going to keep at it until you can?
Well, this is my life. This is what I chose to do. I feel like the most fortunate guy in the world. I've actually done a lot of the things I hoped I'd have a chance to do. This is my 35th record. I've outlived a lot of my critics.
You know the sky's been crying.
That's John Hammond. The latest album in his 50-year recording career is called Timeless. Mr. Hammond, thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
I stood the sky and cried.
Students are still on alert at Princeton University and the University of California in Santa Barbara after outbreaks of bacterial meningitis there late last year. Most college students get a meningitis vaccine, but it doesn't protect against this particular strain, meningitis B. These recent outbreaks were so serious, the FDA allowed the use of a vaccine that's not been approved in the U.S. The schools will administer a second dose of the vaccine in the coming weeks. Meningitis B causes blood poisoning, which can be devastating. The bacteria releases toxins that attack blood vessels and destroy circulation. Andy Marceau knows this all too well. 10 years ago, he was a senior at the University of Kansas, just weeks from graduation, when he says he started to feel a little unwell.
I was working part-time covering high school sports, and I was out at a softball game the night before, and I had to leave early because I started to get flu-like symptoms, and it came on pretty suddenly, the cold sweats, the nausea, the high temperatures. I decided I was just going to go to bed, and then if I still felt sick the next morning, I would go to the doctor.
By the next morning, Andy couldn't walk. His arms were covered with a strange purple rash.
I just wanted to stay in bed that morning, and if I had done that, I almost certainly would have died.
A friend insisted on taking him to the campus health center. He was immediately airlifted to a hospital in Kansas City.
I blacked out when we got there, and I don't remember much of the next 3 weeks. Overnight, I went from healthy 22-year-old college student to intensive care, on a ventilator, lungs failing, fighting for my life.
This didn't turn into an outbreak. The University of Kansas went to great lengths to make sure anyone who had contact with Andy got preventative antibiotics. Andy was put into a medically induced coma for 3 weeks to allow his body to heal.
The bacteria was releasing toxins that was burning thousands of tiny holes in my blood vessels, and that rash I saw on my arms was actually just thousands of little bruises. And so I was losing circulation not only to my organs, but also to my extremities. And so by the time I woke up 3 weeks later, my limbs were literally rotting while still attached to my body.
That's what you woke up to seeing your body in that condition, your extremities.
Exactly. I didn't see it initially because my arms and legs were covered in bandages. And the doctors, you know, they tried to prepare me and they told me, you have tissue damage equal to third-degree burns over 30% of your body. But, you know, nothing that they tell you can prepare you for when they take those bandages off and you see your limbs have turned black. I mean, and your fingers and toes are curling up and dying while still attached to you. At that point, it's dealing with this tissue damage. And the question is, how much of your limbs are going to have to be amputated? How much can be saved if you do aggressive burn treatments? And the aggressive burn treatments, basically, they just wet down that dead skin and they start slicing into it until you bleed, because at that point they know they've reached something that's still alive. And so I went through weeks and weeks of those treatments to try and save as much of my limbs as possible. And in the end, I lost the front half of both feet, so all my toes are gone, and I lost all of my fingers except my right thumb.
It just sounds like the most just hideous thing to go through.
It's incredibly traumatic. I mean, I had nightmares about it for months afterwards, and really the nightmares ended when I started writing about it.
The timing seems so dreadful as well, looking at this from the outside, that you're about to enter the real world. And how did that change your sense of what your plans were going to be from that point?
In a way, the timing was really good for me because I had never really been tested or challenged growing up, even throughout school. It prepared me for a career in journalism. I've already been laid off once. And, you know, getting through that experience, I think, stemmed a lot from going through that process of rehab and learning to walk again and learning to function again, which was very much like two steps forward, one step back.
As a working journalist, you lost all of your fingers. You just have one thumb. So how do you work with your disability, dealing with the writing and that sort of thing?
I taught myself to hold a pen and write again, and I did a lot of that from my wheelchair that first year out of the hospital. And then as far as typing, I use my right thumb, and I have a little nub of my left thumb, and I just kind of peck away at the keys with those two thumbs. And what I like to tell people is that my brain holds me back more than my hands at this point when I'm writing. So
the title of your book, How Meningitis Nearly Killed Me, Then Changed My Life for the Better, can you talk about how it did change your life for the better and how you're doing now?
Yeah. My basic goal in life before all of this happened was comfort. I wanted to be comfortable. While it may have been very difficult for me, I can see now that experiencing that pain made me a better person. And not only that, it created so much good in the world around me because there was so much compassion that poured out towards me because I was going through this pain. And so if you look at it from that broader perspective, not from the self-centered why me perspective, then you get the sense that, you know, this really was worth the pain. It was rewarding.
Andy Marceau is a reporter for the Topeka Capital Journal. His book is called Worth the Pain: How Meningitis Nearly Killed Me, Then Changed My Life for the Better. Andy, thank you.
Well, thank you.
As a father of two young kids, I am very excited about a new segment we're starting right now about parenting. We're calling it The Kids Table. For those of you who hate hearing people talk about their kids, stick with us, because we have the perfect guest to kick this off, actor Hank Azaria. He's actually making a documentary series about fatherhood from the perspective of someone who never wanted to be a dad.
I am not a children kind of person. I don't really like kids and don't gravitate towards them. They make me nervous when I'm around them. I didn't particularly like myself as a child.
Well, Hank did become a father, and his son is now 4. I know from personal experience, that's when kids start to ask deep, complicated questions. I wanted to know how Hank handled one of the big ones. What happens when you die?
Sadly, my dad passed away this past year, so death came up with my son.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazingly hard. He got really upset about it, as you might imagine. I mean, he was like, what do you mean we're not going to see Grandpa anymore? And he asked, what does it mean, you know? And I'm just scrambling for an answer there. And I said, oh, you know, well, some people feel that you just kind of go to sleep. And I was really happy with that answer. Then I looked online. I'm like, let me just check my work here. And I saw all these things saying, don't tell your child this. What, you know why they say don't tell your child that?
And they'll be terrified to go to sleep.
There it is. There it is.
Because they're rational human beings.
I did. Well, you put two and two together better than I did. I was like, what?
No, I'd only read that ahead of time. We went through the same thing with our son. It was his, his great-grandfather actually passed away, and he was really close with him. My son asked, so when you're dead, can you think? Which is, that's the big one, right? That's it in a nutshell, right? That's the big one that drives us all crazy.
Right.
And then he said, and this was when his great-grandfather was 93, it's before he passed, he said, maybe Great Oompa could test it for us.
Huh.
Wow. And I had to actually look away for a second, because I wanted to even talk more about him, like if he were a 20-year-old.
That's the thing, too. You think of all kinds of things you want to say, but they're just not old enough.
Yeah.
You realize it's very hard, you know, to talk to one so young. In terms they'll understand, it becomes this impossible, you know, math problem of like, how do I put this in a way that you can, that's appropriate for you? And sometimes there just isn't one. Just the sex thing, you know, we really walked into that one, because my wife and I have a running, we had a running thing we'd say in front of them, just kind of, we'd say, well, we made this guy. And then finally one day he went, hey, how did you make me? We were like, oh, dear. And so we did the old, well, what's your theory? And he had one, and it was startlingly accurate and insane at the same time. His theory was that Dada had a magic wand, okay?
Okay.
And it exploded.
Wow.
And then God gave us a son. How about that for just a shot in the dark theory of how it happens? But man, and he really is with that. He's like, hey, can I have a baby someday? And we're like, sure you can. Of course you can. He goes, can I borrow your magic wand? To me, I'm like, you'll have your own. You'll have your own. Anyway, just wanted to share that one.
That was great. What's been your biggest surprise so far about being a dad?
I thought it would be a lot more of a bummer. I'd feel a lot more put upon by it. And, you know, Kevin Bacon, when I interviewed him, said he talked about how when he and his wife were pregnant, people would say, oh, boy, your life's going to change. And it really would bum him out because he liked his life. And I felt the same way. And he said, but what people don't tell you is your life is going to change for the better. And at the time, I didn't have a child. And I said, yeah, but how? And it's very hard to describe how. But it is true. It does. I'm sure you can attest to that.
Yeah.
I know for me, it was about a lesson in unselfishness that I never, ever could have learned any other way. And I never really realized that being less selfish would make me more grateful and thus more happy. And that's what it's done for me.
Hank Azaria. His AOL documentary web series is called Fatherhood, and you can find a link to it on our website, npr.org.
This conversation is a part of our ongoing series, The Kids Table, a place to talk about all things parenting. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Next up, a man with an incredible jazz pedigree. He got his start with Dizzy Gillespie and continues to thrill audiences with Wayne Shorter. As a composer and bandleader himself, he's in a class of his own. Pianist Danilo Perez. Danilo Perez just released an ambitious new album called Panama 500. His inspiration? Oh, just 500 years of history. Perez tracks the history of Panama, starting with a Spanish discovery of the Pacific Ocean in 1513.
An event that basically changed the dynamic of the world, how the world connected. You know, Panama became a bridge.
A small country that connected the American continents and the world's biggest oceans. A lot of different goods, cultures, and ideas came together at this bottleneck. Danilo Perez wanted this music to evoke those connections.
With the violin representing the European influence, for example, the percussion representing the African influence, combined with jazz, with the rhythm section, the traditional rhythm section. You know, this was very inspiring to me, especially last year when I was doing the Panama Jazz Festival, playing with Ruben Blades, who is a fantastic artist from Panama. And we play a piece by him called Patria, which is a national anthem. And playing that music just brought so much nationalistic feeling to my heart. And then when I went home, I was just so inspired to write. And it was the perfect, appropriate celebration, 500 years. Also, we're celebrating 100 years of the expansion of the canal. So always revisiting Panama, becoming the bridge, becoming the heart of the world. That's what I've been trying to do with my music.
Let's talk about the first track, Rediscovery of the South Sea. You guys are kind of journeying through the jungle, right?
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. As I envisioned this, it's like the Spaniards coming in. The record started like, it just began. It's like, bam. And then all of a sudden, you're going through the jungle, basically, and then you encounter with the indigenous. And then there is this kind of trying to find out what each other is saying. And all of a sudden, all these challenges that pose that kind of encounter and all the struggles are reflecting on the music. There is a section that I even asked the musicians, play like the Spaniard may have gotten lost so many times during this trip without the help of the indigenous when I'm not being able to do this trip.
So. You guys are lost in the jungle?
Exactly, I said to them, play like you're lost in the jungle, you know. And it was fantastic because they literally play lost in the jungle to the point that now we try to do this live and it's very difficult to do.
And now you know your way around, so you're kind of faking it.
Exactly. At the end of the first track, I become the voice of the indigenous Indians in Panama.
Babdumanane Bua,
They come up with a huge message saying this land was given to us alone by our great fathers and great mothers. We have to live in peace and unity. Nobody owns this land.
I'm speaking with pianist and composer Danilo Perez. His new album is called Panama 500. There's an entire suite in this album dedicated to the building of the Panama Canal. It's hard to imagine what an impact, what a pivotal moment that must have been in the country's history.
It's an amazing moment in our life. I mean, to cut the earth in a piece.
We can kind of feel that cutting, like in these rhythmic stabs you have at the piano, like digging away.
Exactly, that's it. And then at the end, I wanted to throw in a little bit of element that the canal really have provided, elements from the Middle Eastern, you know, Middle East. We have a lot of influence from India, a lot of influence from Israel. You know, it's in our music. And I wanted to portray that part too, how far Panama has come, how different the influences and the diversity of our country, basically.
The last piece on the album, it's this beautiful, almost sentimental piece, Panama Viejo, Old Panama. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose to go out on this? Can you talk about that?
Great question. One of the things that makes this record really special to me is I'm just translating a feeling. I don't really have either side or the other. But this piece talks about the challenge that our country has been through with this colonization. There has come a lot of struggle, and that piece was written by Ricardo Fabrega, and that's why I chose to close the record. And on the idea that you gotta learn the history, you gotta be able to move forward, but knowing what happened and to be really aware that all those fierce struggles and challenges that we went through to become a nation that we are, Panama.
That's Danilo Perez. His new album is called Panama 500. Love speaking with you. This is great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For the week ending February 16th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Patrick Murray is technical director with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo Dell'Aquila. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. As long as Ragnarok doesn't happen, we'll be back next week. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.